Bhutan has a reputation for being the happiest place on earth, thanks to its measure of gross national happiness rather than GDP. And happiness is a hot topic today in scientific circles and to the general public who are looking for something more. Our guest this morning went to Bhutan to volunteer at a radio station and found herself soaking up the life lessons Bhutan had to offer. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickard, and I'm glad to be with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This morning we're joined by Lisa Napoli. She's the author of Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. She's a former reporter for the public radio show Marketplace, a columnist at the New York Times, Cyber Times, and she was also an internet correspondent for MSNBC. And we're happy to take your phone calls this morning. Should we be more concerned about happiness for our citizens in the U.S. like Bhutan is? And do you think Bhutan will stay happy when consumer culture comes to town, as it is certainly beginning to do so? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can reach us via email at talk@wpr.org. And Lisa Napoli, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I think a lot of Westerners don't know that much about Bhutan, aside from the phrase gross national happiness that's been written up all over the place. What did you know about Bhutan going in?
I was like most everybody else. I didn't know a whole lot about it. My father thought it was in Africa. So did a lot of people. A lot of people still will say, is that in the Middle East? Is that in Africa? But I knew it was in Asia, and I knew about the happiness measurement. And I also knew that it didn't have television until about 10 years ago. But other than that, I knew very, very little about it.
And set us up a little here. So this is not the usual thing that a person just gets to go and live in Bhutan for 6 months. How did you wind up with this amazing invitation?
Well, so Bhutan, one of the reasons most people don't know much about Bhutan is because Bhutan has kept the world out for a very long time. Until about 40 years ago, tourists weren't allowed in. And that was one big reason why people didn't know about it. Another reason is that it's tiny and it's sandwiched between Tibet, Nepal, and India. So it's about 650,000 people in the landmass the size of Switzerland, just surrounded by all these gigantic, very populous countries. So it's kind of a lost world, and they liked it that way. They didn't want people coming in. Most of the people there are subsistence farmers. Also, until 40 years ago, there were no roads. There was no currency. Still today, there are many places without electricity, although that's changing pretty quickly. And it's last Shangri-La in the sense that it was untouched by outsiders and very pure culture, very beautiful, beautiful, pristine environment. So,
and
that's an amazing, amazing thing in itself, especially living in downtown Los Angeles as I do.
And you were in the media. You worked for Marketplace and a lot of other news companies. But one of the things that most appealed to you, kind of ironically, was this fact that Bhutan had very little media. For a long time, TV wasn't even allowed.
Yes, you're right. That's what was really interesting for me as a career journalist was that it was just the reason I was being asked to go work there or volunteer there was because this was the first commercial radio station that was starting up. They only had one other radio station. It was on only a few hours a day. And this radio station was a youth-oriented radio station. And it turns out that it was being allowed to start because soon a democratic form of government would be elected for the very, very first time. It wasn't clear when exactly that would happen. The monks and the astrologers, since it's a Buddhist kingdom, decide those dates. But I was asked to come and help lay the groundwork for this evolving media culture because media were seen as an important tool for the implementation of democracy, which is very relevant now with all the things that are going on in the news, of course.
And so this radio station was called Kuzu FM. Mm-hmm. And tell us about that station and what they wanted you to do when you got there.
Sure. So Kuzu Zampola is the way you say hello in Dzongkha, which is the native tongue of Bhutan. And so it was Hello FM. And Kuzu FM was just about up and running for a couple of months by the time I got there 4 years ago this month, actually 4 years ago in January, and I was there through March. And they wanted me to help professionalize them. It was actually really interesting because as somebody who was very focused on work and very, very deadline oriented, for the first time in my life, I didn't really know exactly what they wanted me to do. And it turns out when I got there that they didn't either. They just sort of wanted an advisor, somebody to watch over what they were doing and give them suggestions, maybe help them create programs. But it was a very loose sort of assignment, which in many ways was very freeing for me and instructional, because it's only when you aren't focused on a specific task that your mind is free enough to think about new ideas and new things. So that was a very exciting gift that Bhutan gave me, of many gifts. And just hanging out in the radio station all day, you know, it's radio stations are cool nexus points for communities, and people come in, and especially in a place like Bhutan where it was so brand new, everybody was tuned into this radio station. They were so excited that there was something on the airwaves, that transistor radios sold out in the stores, and people's friends would stop by the station. People would stop by with new ideas. So that made it really super exciting, too, because it was this new presence in the town, and everybody loved having it there.
And I love how you describe those first months on the air, too. People would call up just to say that they liked the music, or maybe someone else had called in, and they would call up and say, I liked the voice of that guy who just called in. And it just became this kind of organic community stopping point.
Yeah, which is what radio was, probably is in a way where you are too. And it is, it just isn't the same that it used to be, because we have so much media coming at us right now. I'm old enough to remember when there were three television networks. So even though I didn't walk into the television station, I felt a different sort of ownership of the media than you do now, when it's, you know, someone was just showing me their iPad 2 here. So there's media coming at you everywhere, and we forget the sort of purity of just mind and spirit when you don't have things pummeling at your brain all day. And that's how Bhutan was 4 years ago with Kuzu FM. It was just one new entry, and it was a very exciting thing.
Well, you mentioned everybody. That Bhutan gave you a lot of gifts, and getting to live in this atmosphere without a lot of media saturation was one of them. What were some of the other things that really struck you about Bhutan and stayed with you?
Well, there's something about living and being a minority in a place, and being a welcome minority, that really puts a fine point on the fact that it's not all about you. And I, you know, like to think that I didn't think the world revolved around me before, but it really puts a fine point on it when you get on a plane and travel literally halfway around the world, and you see that people, you know, humans are humans everywhere. They look completely different than you, but they're humans, and they're living in maybe more rustic conditions, rural conditions, but they are wanting the same things as you: love, shelter, food, community. And the Bhutanese have a really good thing going with community that's changing very quickly, in part because of this evolving media culture and because of the evolving technology of roads and electricity. And that is that they have the community going that many of us here, certainly I was one of those people, was craving. Multi-generations in one house. They didn't think anything of having multiple generations living in one home. A very casual attitude toward hanging out. You know, here you make an appointment with a friend because, you know, you would never just drop by. Again, maybe that's a little bit different in Wisconsin in some places, but people are too busy. It's seen as disrespectful. But there, you would just drop in, and if you weren't there, I'd sit with your brother and have tea and hang out, and then we might go for a walk, and then the night would go by. And that's, there's something about that simplicity of daily life, which is just so nourishing and beautiful and lost in our crazy deadline-oriented world. So that was a big gift. It was also a big gift to live in a place where people are openly very spiritual and religious. Here, you know, people by dint of the framework of our governance, you know, church and state are separate. And that's a good thing. It's an important thing. It's an important foundation of our country. But there, because it's not separate, and most people are practicing the same religion, Buddhism, very openly, there's something very beautiful about being able to see people worship so openly, especially that religion, which is beautiful and mysterious and different than I assumed it would be. And there was, that was a very beautiful part of it for me. It sort of tapped into me an unspoken spirituality and religiousness that I didn't express, because we're not really, you know, welcome to do that a lot of the time here in this country. So,
and you open the book with the story of climbing a path high up into the Himalayas, which has a sacred significance, but the Bhutanese apparently do it quite a lot. Could you tell us about that journey and what that was?
Yes, yeah, Bhutanese are used to walking everywhere anyway, but they're really especially used to walking on pilgrimage to spots that are sacred for, as you say, for specific reasons, specific days. And in the start of the book, and in my real true life, this walk that we took up to Tiger's Nest, which is the place where Buddhism was supposedly brought to Bhutan centuries ago on the back of a tiger, this Guru Rinpoche rode in to this particular spot 10,000 feet high, magnificent vistas. There was something about walking up there with a bunch of people who I just met, a couple of other expats and a couple of people from the radio station, that melted away all of the sadness I felt about my life at that moment in time. I was in my early 40s when I first went to Bhutan, and I was feeling that thing that people often feel when they get to midlife. Why had I not gone this way? Why did I take that road? I thought about a lot about the things I didn't have, and something about that walk up to Tiger's Nest made me start to think about all the things I did have and all the opportunities I had and how fortunate I'd been in my life in a way that I'd never thought about my life before. And so that walk in particular holds a very sacred memory for me. And being in the company of people you don't know, and how quickly you can feel you know someone when you're in a rigorous place with them, or an unusual place, specifically a particularly beautiful place, it washed over me, and as I say, it melted away the sadness, and it made me start thinking of my life from a point of abundance rather than a point of lack. So it was really, in many ways, a religious or spiritual transformation, just being in that one place.
So obviously, hearing you talk about it, you sound happy, joyous, even this many years later. And it brings us back to where we started with this gross national happiness measure that they have in Bhutan. Yes. And I wonder if you think it's true. I mean, a cynical Westerner might say, oh, that's just a marketing gimmick, the gross national happiness thing. Is it for real? Do you think the Bhutanese are actually happier than Westerners?
Well, you know, it's a complicated thing, because the gross national happiness phrase was coined as an aside in a conversation that the king, the then king of Bhutan, had around 40 years ago when he was starting to allow things to open up there. And it took on a life of its own. It became a marketing slogan. It wasn't intended to be a marketing slogan. But there is truth to it, in the sense that if you substitute out the word happiness, which is a loaded word, right? We all, you know, what makes you happy may not make me happy. But if you substitute out well-being and the idea that the king was committed to the well-being of his people, he wanted them to continue to be spiritual. He wanted them to continue to have this beautiful environment. He wanted them to continue to trust the governance around them. And those were the elements that were seen for him as the key principles as he opened up his country to the outside world. He didn't want the environment to get destroyed because he was choosing to open up. He didn't want the people to have to be harried and commuting 2 hours each way every day just because the country was opening up. So if you look at that kind of thing, that kind of metric of well-being, there's no way to measure somebody's happiness. It's the Westerners who sort of forced Bhutan to come up with a scale, so to speak. The Bhutanese don't think about it. The Bhutanese just are inherently content with their daily lives, because part of it is their faith to accept what you have and to tread the middle path as you develop. But it was also, it's just inborn in them to be pleased with the surroundings. That doesn't mean they don't want more. That's the complex part of it.
Lisa Napoli is our guest this hour. She's the author of the new book, Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. She's been a former reporter for the public radio show Marketplace, and she's been a columnist at the New York Times, Cyber Times, and an internet correspondent at MSNBC. And we're looking forward to hearing from you this morning. Have you perhaps been to Bhutan? Do you get the sense that there is this contentment in Bhutan that maybe you don't find anywhere else? And what do you think about gearing a country toward happiness, looking at well-being instead of measures of wealth? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And you can send us an email, if you'd rather, to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Until a couple months ago, if you wanted a cell phone in Bhutan, you only had one choice. B-Mobile, owned and operated by the government. Then, this past spring, a privately owned competitor was let in. And in this peaceful Buddhist country, a cell phone war erupted.
Tashi Cell, keep in touch.
Tashi Cell debuted with a capitalist flourish few people in this poor Himalayan nation have ever experienced. Banners flew on the streets of the capital city, and roadside stands were set up to lure customers in. Then came the bombshell offer, unlimited free calls for 10 weeks.
So we have to try, whatever we can, in any ways we can, to get a customer base.
A report that our guest this morning, Lisa Napoli, filed a while back about cell phones in Bhutan. Lisa Napoli, the author of Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. I'm Veronica Rickert, happy to be back with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And that kind of gets at the question, Lisa, of media and its effect on well-being. As we talked about earlier, one of the things that drew you to Bhutan was the fact that the media were just starting to trickle in, television, internet. There were a couple of newspapers that got started while you were there as well. What do you think the effect is of the media on well-being, having seen it happen and unfold there in Bhutan?
It's so rich and interesting to think about, because we can't even imagine what it's like without a screen everywhere. It is such an amazing experience for me, having covered the early days of the internet in particular, to have been in a place and watching this whole infrastructure unfold, that story you just played, the idea that the competition of a new cell phone company would just change the equation for everything. But when you start to think about how important it is, even before we talk about actual media, a road connecting your village to my village, and what a huge difference that makes, especially in a mountainous place. And then when you add to that the idea that education comes in, and that opens your mind to new things and new ideas and new possibilities for your daily life. And then you add to that electricity and how that alters the fabric of your days. And, you know, fast forward to the internet and being able to be connected on Facebook to people you don't even know in places that you may never go. It's kind of mind-boggling. And I had been so immersed in all of this stuff as, you know, a journalist for 25 years. And of course, I knew that it was a change. I'd watched the internet come in and change everybody's lives. Email, you know, some people probably listening to this can't remember the time before email, but I do well. And it's such an interesting thing to think about a place where everybody at the same time is learning to use these tools. And of course, everybody innately wants to communicate with each other. So the minute you don't have to explain a cell phone, you show someone a cell phone, they want one, they understand it, and they want to use it more. And it's funny because all those tools there are exactly the same and yet completely different than here. For instance, there's no voicemail in Bhutan. So when you think about voicemail and how it's changed the way we communicate, I don't even ever have to talk to you. I can call you up and leave you a message. You can call me back and leave me another message. It changed changes how you and I relate to one another, whether we're old friends or doing business or whatever. And it's in Bhutan that doesn't exist. So this whole idea of calling someone is relatively new, and it's relatively still kind of untainted by the next generation of technology. And then you talk about media coming in, and not just media that they're creating themselves, the Bhutanese, but media that's coming in from here. And you have people who've never seen the world, who've never been seen a plane, much less been on a plane, and they've got CNN coming into their living rooms showing them, you know, quake aftermath or Libya or places they never imagined. And of course, the same thing was true here, but it's just that this entire country is having this experience simultaneously, every generation, all at once. It's as I say, it's mind-boggling to me and very thrilling. I mean, to me as a journalist, it was just an absolute thrill. And when you layer onto that the election of their first government, and they're enacting the first constitution, all at the same time, it's pretty cool. It's a story of a lifetime.
Let's take another, well, I should say, our first phone call here. Let's go to Terry, who's with us from Madison. Hi, Terry.
Hello.
Hey, go ahead.
My question is, our parish is sponsoring several Bhutanese families who
yes.
are immigrating here. And the word
yes.
I believe I've heard is refugee.
Yes.
And the question is, what are they refuging from?
I'm very glad you asked. And in every community I've gone into on this book tour, there's a presence of these Nepali refugees from Bhutan. And this is why there's a lot of irony in my title, Shangri-La and Happiest Kingdom on Earth, because of course there is no happiest place on Earth. And it's particularly, sort of discordant with that Bhutan has these Nepali refugees. What happened basically is when citizenship ID cards were granted about 40 or so years ago in Bhutan, so that students, so as the place was developing, educational systems were put in place, healthcare, Western healthcare was put in place, and people were given ID cards so that they could use those services of the government. And people who couldn't prove that they were quote unquote ethnically Bhutanese, many, many Nepali immigrants who'd lived in the country in some cases for generations, were basically kicked out. And they were kicked out and they were not reabsorbed by Nepal because they hadn't lived in Nepal in some cases ever. So they've languished in refugee camps along the border. And what's happened is in the last couple of years, after 20 years now of this refugee situation, which was growing and growing, people living in the camps, the population kept growing, new birth, and the people have been started to be relocated around the world, and most of them have come to this country, and communities have welcomed them in. Many church communities have welcomed them in. And it is extremely discordant to hear that this place is so happy and they're refugees, but they're not refugees necessarily. They are refugees, and it's a very startling and distressing thing because Bhutan doesn't talk about it a whole lot. And as I find, a lot of people are working in the communities with the refugees, but they don't really understand the backstory of the situation because the Nepalis don't speak a lot of English a lot of the time, and they're afraid to talk about the situation. So it's a very interesting and disturbing part of Bhutan's history. Bhutan, for its part, says that it couldn't keep the people there. If it was going to offer free schooling and free health care, it needed to keep the population down because they just couldn't afford to do that. But, of course, it's not a very Buddhist thing to kick people out who've been working in your country and living there for years. So it's a dark part of their past. It was nothing that happened while I was there. It wasn't something I ever witnessed. There's another book, a beautiful book about Bhutan called Beyond the Sky and the Earth by a woman named Jamie Zeppa. She was a young teacher from Canada in Bhutan in the 80s. And she writes about the refugee situation as it was happening while she was there. So if you want to read more, I'm happy to also point you in the direction of other resources about this subject. It's a very important subject.
And the name of that book once more?
Beyond the Sky and the Earth.
Beyond
by
the
Jamie
Sky
Zeppa.
And the Earth. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for bringing that up, Terry. That was fascinating. I had no idea. Another call here from Susan in Madison. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I've always been interested in Bhutan even before the happiness quotient, and the part that drew me to Bhutan was their aesthetic sense, their traditional arts, their religious arts, their everyday architecture, construction.
Yes.
It seems like they've woven function and beauty together in their everyday life. I wish you would comment on that.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Thank you so much. Yeah, you know, in a place that doesn't have a lot of consumer, doesn't have any consumer culture or didn't for generations, what did you wear? You wore the national dress, which for the women is a very simple, beautiful woven cloth, and anybody into textiles may already know about the Bhutanese weaving. It's magnificently beautiful, and it takes about a year to make one of these garments, not because of the intricacy of it's just a big piece of cloth. And then the men wear something called a go, which is similarly beautiful weaving. And basically those things, very colorful, natural dyes, and very intricate, but you didn't have 10 or 15 or 20 dresses. You had this one or maybe two because there was no need for it, and there was no way to access more materials. So because of that, and as you say, with the arts, the religious arts, their beautiful paintings, beautiful religious scrolls, Buddhist scrolls, tendrils or giant embroidered, like the sides of a building, you know, many, many feet tall, 25 feet tall scrolls that are worked on for years and years and years. And the woodwork is magnificent too. And every house, every structure, any structure in all of Bhutan looks similar. And they all have this very ornate, colorful woodwork around the window frames. So it's quite a startling place to see, not just because of the pristine environment, but because of the sheer color and beauty of this handiwork. And there is a big movement in the country to make sure that this kind of thing gets preserved. That national dress is mandated to be worn by kids in schools and by people going to the office. So that's one way that they're keeping that culture alive and also, you know, supporting that kind of handiwork that is, of course, rapidly being replaced by more modern things to the consternation of the elders and the preservationists.
It sounded in the book that when you were there, there was a lot of investment going on in preserving the national culture. And even the airport, you say, had this sort of wooden scroll work and colorful. It didn't look like a modern airport.
Yes.
And I wonder if you think that's still being held up now as an ideal in Bhutan, or whether they've sort of taken their finger off that dike.
No, they fortunately do work to preserve that, but of course it's also embellished. So you now have people building new buildings which look like traditional Bhutanese architecture, except maybe they'll have plate glass in the front of it to make it look more modern. Or that national dress, which is, you know, for a Bhutanese woman who's been putting it on all her life, she's used to wrapping it the way a man wraps a tie without thinking about it after 20,000 times. The Bhutanese dress is now being altered to make it a little bit simpler to wear. And so there's tweaks to it. Or, you know, you were playing some music that is Bhutanese pop music. It's sort of a variation of traditional Bhutanese music jazzed up with modern touches. So it's like everything in the world. It gets, you know, sort of filtered through the lens of a more modern populace, but it's also, as you say, there's the danger of it dissolving away. I think that the people in Bhutan are pretty committed to it, and that, in fact, is part of one of the pillars of gross national happiness, as they've sort of been quantifying it in recent years, and that is cultural preservation. You know, it's great that we're modernizing, but don't let our traditions die.
There is a university in Texas, right, that has some Bhutanese architecture?
Yes. I'm so glad that you asked that. This is an amazing story too, Veronica, about just about media and the impact of media even before our 24/7 media culture. There was a National Geographic article about Bhutan in 1914 that a woman read. It's April 1914 for anybody out there who has a collection in their basement. A woman in El Paso read that article and loved the architecture, loved seeing this place that very few people had ever seen, and asked her husband to rebuild the school that he managed. He was the dean of, which was then the Texas School of Mines. It's now UTEP, University of Texas, El Paso, in the style of Bhutanese architecture. And today, you don't have to go to Bhutan. You can go to El Paso, Texas, and see the UTEP campus, which actually has quite a lot of Buddhist scrolls and artifacts, like I was talking about, archery bows, that's the national sport, and prayer wheels. And every single building on this campus has been built in the style of Bhutanese architecture. Of course, it's to code, to U.S. code, and it's more modern than the typical Bhutanese structure, but still, it's there, and it's pretty phenomenal that one magazine article inspired this woman who never, ever traveled there. She couldn't if she'd wanted to because people weren't allowed. Pretty amazing.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Yeah, thanks for telling us about that. And we have a couple of great emails here I want to get to. This one from Jim in Madison, who writes, I saw a wonderful movie about Bhutan at the Wisconsin Film Festival a few years ago called Travelers and Magicians.
Yes.
It was my first real view of the country, and it looked wonderful and lovely, even if the main character was trying really hard to get out. And he wants to know, is it common for Bhutanese to want out, even if they're supposedly so happy?
Yes. In fact, that's a huge theme in my book, too, from a different take than Travelers and Magicians. I like to call it the It's a Wonderful Life of Bhutan, because it is about this handsome young man who has his whole life ahead of him. And he all he wants is to get out of his village and get to the United States. That's going to make life perfect for him. And it's about how he can't do that. And it's, you know, you see gorgeous Bhutanese landscape along the way. My book is about a young woman who I meet at the radio station who wants to come visit here. And she does. And it's about what happens to her. It's very, very common for young Bhutanese. And again, it's ironic, especially with this terrible refugee situation. Young Bhutanese want to come to the United States because they've been watching television for the past 10 years since it came in. And they only have access to the tourists who come to Bhutan, who are the most wealthy Americans or wealthy people from all around the world, because it's not cheap to get to Bhutan and or to stay there. There's a very high tourist tariff to go there, $250 a day now. So Bhutanese have this impression that everybody in America is extremely wealthy and lives like desperate housewives. They kept saying, you know, we're sorry your kitchen isn't bigger. You're not in desperate. You know, we see desperate housewives. And they want to come. They want to come here. And of course, they get here, as many people do, and they realize not everybody does live that way. And it's, you know, it's one of those things you can't tell a 22-year-old person anything. They've got to see it for themselves. But every time I go to Bhutan and talk to people online, which I do practically every day, people are looking for opportunities to come be a nanny here. Mm-hmm. It's they don't realize how good they've got it.
We're talking this hour with Lisa Napoli. She's the author of the new book, Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. And we're looking forward to taking more of your phone calls and emails this morning. Do you have a fascination with Bhutan? Have you ever thought of going to Bhutan or know someone who has? And what do you think about what it takes to make a content society? In Bhutan, obviously, they have certain measures they've taken. And we wonder what you think about a society geared more toward well-being instead of toward wealth. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this Friday morning on the Ideas Network as we talk about Bhutan with our guest Lisa Napoli. She's the author of the book Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. And let's get going again with an email here from Melinda, who says, I read Lisa's book and I was curious about the high fees to visit Bhutan. Why do they seem to discourage visitors, even though tourism could be a source of revenue? And, you know, in the book, it's clear that Bhutan is not a wealthy place. It seems like this would be a pretty good source of income.
Well, it is. It's actually the second biggest source of income for the country, and they value tourism enormously. But they don't have the infrastructure, nor do they want to have the infrastructure to accommodate spiritual backpackers, the kind of people you, I guess, you see all over India and Nepal. So what they've done is it's high value, low volume tourism is what they call it. So they put a very big barrier to entry, and it's up to $250 a day per person. You can spend more, but you can't spend less. And the government takes a slice of that, a big slice of that, about $65. So it's a big revenue generator for them. But again, they're interested in cultural and environmental preservation, and they know if they open the floodgates, people would just pour in, and they just don't have the infrastructure to accommodate that. So they'd rather focus on the top dollars.
But you didn't have to pay that $200 at the time, did you?
No, I've been there 6 times over the last 4 years, and I go there as a volunteer. So
is that the way to go? Should you go as a volunteer?
Well, that's a good question, except that and I get people writing to me all the time asking for ways to go volunteer. It's very difficult. I think someone said to me when I first got to Bhutan, it's your karma that you're here. And I think I got extremely lucky, because I've tried to help route teachers or physical therapists. A few weeks ago in Arizona, I met a midwife who wants to go. And it's difficult to get people opportunities. Again, they don't have the infrastructure. They're not set up, you know, even in China, there's a series of orphanages and they all need help. They need material help. They need physical help, labor. You know, you hear about people going on church missions to Haiti or wherever. Places are better equipped and have, you know, longer term relationships with relief organizations or Peace Corps or that sort of thing. They don't have that sort of thing set up in Bhutan.
So you really have to make a contact with an individual institution, maybe know someone on the inside and try to go in that way.
Yeah, and even then it's complicated, because, as I say, I route teachers there often. They have a teacher shortage the way we do here, and they teach kids in English, and it's tough to find opportunities for people. But no, I did not have to pay that tax. I couldn't pay that tax.
You do have good karma, don't you?
I'm lucky. Very fortunate. Very fortunate.
Okay.
And I didn't even know what I was getting when I got to go there. That was the other amazing thing. So,
well, let's take another phone call. This is John with us from Saukville. Hi, John.
Oh, yes. Hi. Say, I'm driving here along with my wife, and we just happened to pick up on the show. We've been to Bhutan 8 times, going back to 1996, I think was the first time we went.
Wow.
And the amazing thing is how it changes every time we go. We're going back again in November. Our primary interest in, we just love Bhutan, obviously.
Clearly.
Keep going back. The part that we like the most about it is the trekking aspect, and maybe your guest has already talked about that, but every time we go, we do a trek, and Bhutan, little by little, is opening up different areas of the country to trekking that previously had not been opened. And
yes.
It is absolutely wonderful to walk into a village that has never before or has seldom had any contact with Westerners. And just wanted to bring that up and also bring up the aspect of the environment is so intact. Bhutan has birds and mammals that are practically extinct in other Himalayan countries.
Yes.
And again, it's the Buddhist philosophy, and I think it's also just the lack of development that has protected all of this.
John, have you just gone as a tourist, and you paid the $200, $250 fee, or have you been a volunteer?
I lead trips for the Sierra Club International Outings. And so that's been a wonderful blessing for me to be able to. I really probably could not have afforded to make all these trips on my own. But the longest we've been in Bhutan at a time has been about a month.
Wow!
And, so I would love to go and spend more time there. But I would also say it's a harsh country in some respects in terms of standard of living, especially when you get into the outlying areas and. The Buddhist philosophy, I think, is what makes it so particularly appealing it's just a wonderful, welcoming, accepting, simple way of living. And every time we go there, we come back and we're totally refreshed and able to much better deal with the complexity of our society.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, John. It's wonderful to hear about your experiences there.
Yeah, that's great. It's really, that's been so exciting for me about this book tour is everywhere I go, you meet people like this who have had incredible experiences there. And unlike anywhere I've ever seen in my life before, people are so touched by it. They want to give back. People go to Costa Rica all the time and love it, but you never hear about them wanting to go build a kitchen on the back of a monastery or something. And everybody who goes to Bhutan seems to want to do something for it, or it's like a high that they get from it. It's a pretty amazing thing. And yet, you know, it is complicated that things are changing and you have this situation with the racism of the people who were evicted, and it's a complex place. It's not perfect, but it's in terms of environmental, no one's allowed to scale those Himalayan mountains. They're seen as sacred, and there's something to that, you know. There's a lot to that, especially with what's going on in the world right now.
Well, thank
respect
you so much.
For the environment.
And we'll go to our next call here. Reed with us from Madison. Hey, Reed.
Hi, I just tuned in, and I'm a storyteller who has recently found folk tales attributed to Bhutan. I'm curious to ask the author a couple of things. One is, as you are on the book tour, might you be doing to kind of less sort of say, hey, this is Bhutan, and I visited, and it's a great place to visit, and instead inspire people, maybe directly by, you know, suggestions or whatever, how we in the rest of the world might alter our lives to approximate something like how people in Bhutan live. That's the first part of my question. And the second part is, if you have any awareness of the folklore of the place, what do the tales tell philologically? What do the tales of the place tell about how the people view themselves and how they interact with each other and their environment?
Wow, thanks, you could do a PhD on both of those great questions. The first question is really particularly interesting when you look at how the rest of the world is studying this whole concept of gross national happiness. If you go to grossnationalhappiness.com, Bhutan's been sort of laying out the framework for how to measure it for all the people, all the type A people in the West who want to figure that out. And if you look at Seattle and Brazil and Great Britain, all those places are trying to mimic the concept of these pillars of gross national happiness: time balance, mental health, social connection, cultural vitality, physical health, education, governance, environmental quality. Those are all things that are seen as essential. You know, what good is it to have a lot of money if you're commuting for hours every day? What good is it if you don't see your family or have a rich fabric of life? And those are things that I experienced while I was living there that I love talking about with people, because you can see the switch flipping in their brains. Yeah, my goodness, I'm making a lot of money, but what difference does it make? I don't get to experience my life because I'm so busy all the time. So those are the principles, I think that was your first question, that I'm learning about and that I try to talk about everywhere. And for me, the whole book is about this transformation I had from being a journalist to wanting to give, to seeing that really the role in life is service to other people. And to that end, I'm helping to raise money to hope to build a library in eastern Bhutan. And to the question of folk tales, I'm no expert in the folk tales. There's a fine book written by an author, one of the few published Bhutanese authors, named Kunzeng Choden, beautiful woman and a beautiful writer. And I've read the folk tales. I have not studied them in the way that you are asking. I wish I had, but that's not my thing. But I can say that in the folk tales, you see great love and respect for the environment. And since before it was Buddhist, much of Bhutan practiced Bon animism. That was their religion. And again, I'm no expert in that either, but that is great respect and love for natural beauty. You see that in abundance in everything that's talked about in Bhutan in their stories.
Well, thank you so much, Reed. Those were great questions. And Lisa, I have to follow up. If people want to contribute to the library that you're trying to build or fund in Bhutan, can they help?
Yes, please. We'd love your help, and we'd love suggestions as we're getting this launched. Books2Bhutan.com. And I also ask anybody who travels to Bhutan to please take some books to one of now only two community lending libraries. And I'm happy to tell you more about how to do that and how to direct all of that. But Books2Bhutan.com. And my email is lisa@lisanapoli.com. And on my website, I've actually got some videos of the library, the new and second lending library in the country, and of just some beautiful Bhutanese children who are very funny. And like John was saying, people just had never seen an outsider before. It's an amazing experience to have that.
Okay, we'll put that information up on our Facebook page. If you'd like to help out or you're curious about what kinds of books are needed, you can go to WPR.org/Rickard, and you'll find a link to our Facebook page there. And we have another email here from Larissa in Milwaukee, who wants to know, what kind of food do they eat in Bhutan? I've never seen a Bhutanese restaurant. Is there a reason for that? And reading some of your earlier experiences, I'm guessing there is.
Yes, and as John said, I've lived there for up to several months at a time, but the reason I don't think I fell in love with a Bhutanese man and stayed forever or tried to stow away is the food, because the food's a challenge. It is not like Indian or Chinese food. It is basically a happy meal for a Bhutanese person is what they eat three times a day, and that is a gigantic plate of rice topped with red hot chili peppers used as a vegetable, not a spice, stewed in now processed cheese. It used to be yak cheese, but now that they can have access to processed cheese.
So what, Velveeta? That's what they eat. Something like Velveeta? Yeah.
Big blocks of processed cheese.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my. Three times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And they love it. That's a happy, happy, happy food. That is their food, their main food. And even though there's beautiful stuff like chanterelle mushrooms that grow in abundance in parts of Bhutan, they'll take those and they'll stew those in cheese with chilies too. So I'm not as spicy food person, and I got to watch the carbs to keep the middle age spread from going.
So it's not a foodie's vacation paradise, Bhutan.
No. But the food you get when you pay the $250 a day tourist tax is much different than what I eat.
Why? So, what do you get then?
Well, then they know that outsiders don't like that kind of food. So they sort of. Actually, what you get, I've stayed in a couple of inns in the time I've been there, and one, they brought out a giant basket of toast, probably 20 pieces of bread for me, just for me, because they assume that you eat bread the way they eat rice. But in the finer places where you would stay, I'm told that they're beautiful meals that are, you know, they have a couple of Western chefs who live there, and they've learned to adjust the volume of rice and the volume of the spice. So, yes. Yes.
Well, I want to ask a couple of questions, I guess, how Bhutan has changed since your first foray there. I think you were there in, what was it, 2006?
Seven. First time is 2007.
And, you know, how your own personal life has changed as a result.
Wow. Well, in every way, my personal life has changed. But I'll answer the first question first, and that is there are now 7 radio stations. There are now 7 newspapers. The television station that was created by the Bhutanese 10 years ago has become much more sophisticated. The ads have become much more sophisticated and prevalent. So whereas before consumer culture was just sort of beginning to creep in, now you see ads that are made by Bhutanese about Bhutanese shops, and they're way snazzier. So people are wanting stuff more, and they have access to more stuff, and so you have to advertise it. I say that with some irony. My personal life has changed immensely. I no longer work in the news business, and I don't think I could again. I think it would be hard for me to work in the news business, as nice as it is to be talking to you from the studios of Marketplace right now. My whole perspective on life has changed, again, from a feeling of lack to a feeling of abundance. And I work and do a lot of volunteer work and am very involved in my community in ways I never could be when I was working the job that I was working, the career I was working. And I have a whole different outlook on life, in large part because I've been studying Buddhism and positive psychology, the whole idea of reframing the way you look at the world and the way you think. And that's just changed my very being And I feel much, you know, happy skipping gaily down the street. No, but happy in terms of content and appreciative. And as I said, being aware of the fact that service and helping other people is far more important. Those are sort of more important in my life now.
Well, it must be working for you. You're certainly one of the happiest sounding guests I've heard in a while.
I'm also very, very, very lucky, and I realize it. In large part, I'm so happy to be talking to you. It's a privilege to be able to write a story, much less to be able to talk about it with people. So I thank you for letting me do that.
Well, I'm so glad we've had you on, and I have to ask, by maybe this is the million-dollar question, is Bhutan still the happy place? Is it still the happiest place on earth? A little tongue-in-cheek there, but has it maintained that in the face of this tremendous change, political and economic? Is it still so a happy, well-contented place?
I think you got to go see for yourself. You got to go check it out. And I think the happiest place is always right where you are and where you feel best. But if you want to see something unlike any place you've ever seen, you got to go, and go fast, because it is changing quickly. Thankfully, not that quickly, but it is. Check it out.
Well,
check
Lisa, thank you so very much for being on. It's been a joy.
Oh, same here. Thank you so much to the good people of Wisconsin. I appreciate it.
Lisa Napoli, our guest this morning. She's the author of Radio Shangri-La, When I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. And I want to thank Joe Hartke this morning for technical direction, for finding all the wonderful Bhutanese music we've been listening to this hour as well. And thanks to Erica Janik for some of the clips she has brought to us and for producing this hour, and Rhonda Fanning as well. And don't forget, you can leave your show suggestions, your comments on our Facebook page. Go to WPR.org/Rickert and you'll find a link there as well. And thank you so much for listening and joining in this morning. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'll see you back here next Friday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.